The night sky above the port was the colour of a television tuned to a dead channel. A year here, and he still dreamed of cyberspace, hope fading nightly. All the speed he took, all the turns he'd taken, and the corners he'd cut in Night City, and still he'd see the Matrix in his sleep, bright lattices of logic unfolding across that colourless void.
You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm George Gingell.
I'm Luke Jones, and we're in Ninsei, Night City, Chiba, under a poisoned mercury sky, amid neon-lit alleys of dive bars and black medicine clinics. We're here for the opening of Neuromancer, to witness the lonely and unmourned demise of Henry Dorset Case, one-time cyberspace hotshot turned downward spiralling hustler. Neuromancer made the reputation of its author, William Gibson, upon its release in 1984, and placed him at the head of a new science fictional genre, cyberpunk, a dark, disenchanted, and grubbily material vision of a future transformed by technology. Cyberpunk, a term Gibson himself has tended to avoid, channels such contemporary developments as globalization, the waning of social democracy, and the rise of information technology and computer games, while infusing them with a potent cocktail of desire and pessimism. We're going to read Neuromancer together, and if you don't want the ending spoiled, you should read it yourself first. On the way, we'll be paying special attention to the places, spaces, moods, and materials of the cyberpunk city, the sprawl with all its pleasures and perversities. Before we begin, do you want to say anything about William Gibson?
Yeah, so he was born after the war in somewhere in the middle of nowhere in America, in the South. His father, though, and I think this is an important thing, worked for a construction company building suburbs, essentially, sort of desirable. The way he seems to describe it is like the sort of upper-class white flight suburb construction company. Yeah. And they would travel around staying in the showroom homes built first. So he's perpetually going from place to place in these sort of nowhere, suburban, aspirational, I think, houses. His father dies suddenly when he's fairly young. I got the sense of like 10 or something. How old?
Yeah, I think that's about,
you know,
yeah.
When he's still
when
very
he's
much a child.
Yeah.
That sort of brings about a crisis, as it would do. He returns to live with his mother. They seem to have a fractious relationship. He's then sent to boarding school. Although, actually, I think, like often, the relationship you have with your parents, you emphasise the difference between them. I suspect that they were both interesting, literate people, actually. He was sent off to boarding school, whereupon his mother died also, I think, when he was a mid-teenager. And so, having a rather hard start in life, he then went to live with an aunt, who he seems to have got on with very well, and then drifted around in counterculture through his 20s. Really seemingly doing very much work. Perhaps the, like, dual inheritance sort of was a bit funding or something. I don't get the feeling he was rich, but I also don't get the way he describes it doesn't seem to be pressed in with the normal concerns of making a living.
Also, it was much easier to do that then.
Yeah, sorry, I've spent my adult life in London where it is immensely difficult. Yeah. If you stop for, like, 10 seconds, you're broke. And he sort of noodled around until his mid-30s and or early 30s and then started publishing science fiction. Published short stories in magazines. And then I think this was his first published book.
Yeah, it's his first novel.
I suspect he was working a lot of things. And this whole book feels very highly wrought in its language. It has nothing of the dashed off about it. Okay, so we've got our noir hero, Case.
Okay. The setup is he's a kind of computer hacker. He was very successful, did lots of work for lots of criminals, but then he was poisoned.
He tried to steal from them, and then they've taken his abilities away from him.
Yeah, they've poisoned him with a mycotoxin, which has made him unable to jack into the Matrix. And here he is in this sort of downward spiral of petty crime and amphetamines and kind of tragic romantic involvement and sort of getting ready to die, basically.
The situation is what's interesting, which is that he's in a hyper-modern Chiba, which is the peninsula opposite Tokyo and its industrial port, although it isn't really there. It really is hyper-modern expat, neon, smoke, counterculture, underground.
So from where he is, you look across the bay, you look at Tokyo, which in this world is studded with these enormous arcologies, which are huge, vaguely pyramidal, steel and glass buildings for the enormous industrial conglomerates, within which the drone-like employees live, work, and die.
Although we don't really hear anything about
them. We don't know anything about them, but that's what they represent is a sort of closed, sort of self-contained redoubt of highly organized industrial capital.
Arcology was a well-established idea by this point, and it was one that had been proposed as an optimistic propositional movement in Italy in the late 60s, end of the 60s.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's an ecology of building, which is bigger than an object building. It's so big that it is beyond a town in its own right.
And the name is a portmanteau, so it's also an ecology. It's full of plants and all kinds of other things as well. And it's almost like a space architecture. It's like a space station that happens to be on Earth.
It's what happens when you build so much there isn't a planet left.
Yeah. But we're outside of that. We're on the outside looking in, and we're on this chaotic and sort of entropic slum fringe of the future megalopolis. And Night City is the expat crime district.
It's a sort of terra nullis. It's a sort of one of these places between jurisdictions, like Transnistria, I think. That's how I think. Or, I mean, the more pertinent example, the one we discuss, would be Kowloon Walled City in the 70s and early 80s.
Which was, for those who don't know, it was this strange extraterritorial quirk that was directly under the flight path to...
It was right by it to Hong Kong's old airport before they put it out. So when, after Kowloon, so Hong Kong, when it was originally established, was very small. It was just Hong Kong Island. And then they fought another war and got Kowloon. And then, without wanting to fight another war, they bought the new territories. British Empire bought the new territories, which is the sort of the bulk of the territory of Hong Kong. And in that, there was a small Qing fort, the sovereignty of which was maintained. And after China fell to the communists, it became a Republican enclave, and lots of people flooded in, and it became this tiny sort of like 4 hectare or however many, I don't know, but like a few hectares, massive density with no law in it at all.
Yeah.
And it was this sort of, it's worth looking up because it got built up to an incredible density of shacks, up to sort of 14 stories tall, just one building built on top of another.
Night City was like a deranged experiment in social Darwinism, designed by a bored researcher who kept one thumb permanently on the fast-forward button. Stop hustling and you sank without a trace, but move a little too swiftly and you'd break the fragile surface tension of the black market. Either way, you were gone, with nothing left of you but some vague memory in the mind of a fixture like rats. Though heart or lungs or kidneys might survive in the service of some stranger, with new yen for the clinic tanks. As you can see, we're in. It's kind of a genre setting as well. It's very distinctly a sort of noir tinged.
Those organs in the tanks are being stitched together into stitching a genre out of a few others because it's very noir underworld. But it also has this thick layering of extrapolated sort of future tech, you know, surgery and all that sort of stuff. But it's under the sky laid out under, like a patient etherized on a table or whatever. Modernist disquiet, which then played into, I guess, West Coast noir.
Maybe we should just give a little bit of a sketch of what is sci-fi in this world, of the kind of the technological transformations. So as you say, there's an awful lot of body modification. There's lots of sort of organ trading. People also augment their bodies technologically. There's a lot of kind of incipient sort of cyborg stuff going on. People with camera eyes or knife fingers or robotic arms or...
And also people who I think augment themselves. I wasn't entirely sure what the Microsoft, amusing word, it's actually rather a long time after the company was established. But this seems to be something you sort of plug into the back of your head and affects your brain. Yeah. Seemingly sort of stimulant-y.
Yes, a kind of, it's sort of spongy thing you stick in a plug in your neck.
Yeah, but they're all sort of spraying out behind people's ears. I mean, the really key technology is that there's this thing called the Matrix, which may be familiar to a few of you, although this is its first outing.
Cyberspace, the vast consensual hallucination.
Yeah, which is sort of, you put on this rubberized headset, and you've got sort of arcade controls, and it projects into your brain a spatial representation of the network in sort of cubes and colours and circles. And you can sort of whiz around it by using dials. And notionally, I think it's used for everything, but really it's used, it's like a computer game in that what you do in it, actually, is you hack through walls, which are representations
of security,
to steal money, information. That's the application which is explained. And the sort of three-dimensional representation is very much about objects behind barriers.
It takes place in a world which is extremely grimy and extremely sort of fallen. So there's a lot of discussion of the drifting shoals of waste in the bay. It's very rarely seems to be bright sunlight anywhere. And it's quite clear that there's been a sort of big shattering war at some point, although it's never really spelled out exactly what happened. Noir does something interesting in the context of science fiction. In its original incarnation, noir is normally in and around Los Angeles. And one of the tropes of noir is the kind of seamy reality behind the glamour. It's taking place in and around Hollywood, in and around that great kind of factory of sort of glittering lies. But its stock characters are disenchanted, you know. There's the failed, slightly kind of raddled, older actress. There's the young, kind of hopeful girl who's come to town and been kind of cruelly disappointed in one way or another.
The corrupt businessman.
Everyone is jaded. And if you think even of the kind of the clichés of speech, a very noir detective thing to say is to refer to the kind of phoniness of something, to the kind of hypocrisy. In the context of science fiction, what that allows you to do is to adopt a particular relationship to technology. That technology, like Hollywood, has a certain glamour, has a certain promise. It sort of promises something about the future. It promises something kind of transformative, something which potentially is going to kind of change everything about your sad and unsatisfactory life. And it's something which then you can desperately desire, but also be let down by. And the people, certainly in this early part of the book, are in a way starstruck by a technology which is unable to make their lives better, and which in fact is inflicting a sort of tragedy on them. And this is as true of Case, kind of sat, you know, sitting in the bars dreaming about cyberspace, as it is about his tragic partner in this early chapter, Linda, who wants nothing but to play computer games and do amphetamines all day, basically.
But when we say technology, I think it isn't technology as a whole, but it is the sort of shiny image of the future. Whereas in the noir of Los Angeles, you could say, you know, Manifest Destiny has run its course. We've got right to the ocean. This bright hope of California, technology, movies, the future, the underside of that. This is the underside of the allure of gadgetry, but its image is the key, yeah. I think. It's not that societal progress is the thing which is causing the problem. It's this sheeny glow decaying into piles of plastic boxes of sort of defunct electronics. So it's about the decay, I think, of the image of that brittle veneer, the sort of decayed, you know, it's like the Apple phone box has kind of like that sheeny image has kind of decomposed and spilled all its guts out.
And this sort of conflation is very clear in some of the earlier short stories. If in Burning Chrome, for example, one of the characters is this young girl who wants to be a star in the SimStims, which are the sort of immersive virtual reality movies of the day. But in order to do that, she has to get her eyes exchanged for these sort of bright blue cameras. And so, you know, you can see the conflation of the dream of being a star, but also the dream of what technology is going to do for you in your life.
And something you can say in that is that the genre sampling is conscious. This isn't unconsciously like noir.
So, well, maybe we'll just do a tiny little bit of narration. Case is in trouble because he owes money to a local tough guy. He's high on these octagonal pills, and he's sort of scrabbling around to try and find the money to pay this guy off so he won't kill him. And he realises as this is going on that somebody seems to be following him. And so the first chapter is him running around various places trying to raise the money and also trying to escape from this pursuer.
For me, it's one of the most fun bits in the book. I really like the... Yeah. Because it's got so much of this description of place and the environment, which is exciting. And he goes to visit so many interesting people. There's a real kind of cavalcade of... It's very much like one of the sort of simple... Do you know Stray Dog by Kurosawa? It's a film made in 1948. Sorry, I'm going off topic, but it's a lovely little thing of like going around the city, seeing all the like underside of the city, all these, and it's a bit like that. Yeah. And the character is one part like diehard action hero and one part schmuck. Yeah, you know, come out a toughy side, you know, computer filled sacks and submachine guns. But at the same time, he's just, like, flailing around. He gets this, like...
He's completely strung out as
he's
well.
He's completely strung out. He gets this, like, sort of weapon, which is basically a, like, stick with some metal things on the end. He's, like, flailing around, jumping at every shadow. He seems to be a bit of an idiot. But at the same time as being this sort of this funny schizophrenic portrayal that you feel would look quite different from the outside than the inside. And he goes to this succession of nice scenes. So he goes... He's trying to, like, rent a gun... And so he goes to the kind of, like, seedy gun rental guy. He's trying to find out someone to chase him. So he goes to one of his, the people he buys drugs off, who's this kind of 40s, 50s stock character of an import-export merchant, you know, with his sort of stall and seedy office with, like, low spinning fan and filing cabinets. And you walk and you get a sense of the streets and things, which are very, you know, very noir-y. And it's a nice kind of... It's a nice set piece. And there's the bar, which I think is probably the central location. This washed-up expat dive bar.
Yeah, the Chatsubo.
Slightly in the kind of Casablanca mould, but more sci-fi with its kind of semi-robot bartender and seedy sailors and prostitutes and things. Yeah. Where the action takes place.
Yeah, there's a fun bit where he sort of runs into an arcade and hides behind the big augmented reality style explosion when someone gets a high score and then runs upstairs and then kicks his way through
it's a 10 megaton in Battle Tank Europa or something.
and sort of runs up and then like sort of is kicking his way through this whole sort of hidden backstage upstairs of cheap plastic doors and then jumps out the window and lands on a pile of soggy chipboard and it's permanently raining and everything is extremely kind of decrepit.
I mean, that first chapter is extremely filmic. Yeah. It really feels like it takes a lot from the author watching films. It's filmic, I think, in that it's receiving a lot of the mode from fast cut, you know, the really good chase.
Towards the end of the chapter, he meets up with the I think he's actually an organ trader, the guy who he owes money to, and he pays him off. And then, in a moment which is also very filmic, he finally is able to go home after all that. And waiting for him in his flat is the person who's actually being pursuing him, who, of course, is not at all who he thinks she is. I'm not going to do a voice.
Do it!
What would the voice be?
I'm just gonna do it.
Yeah. Close the hatch real slow, friend. You still got that Sunday night special you rented from the waiter. She sat with her back to the wall at the far end of the coffin. This, I've got to explain that now. It's just
they
like
all live in capsule hotels.
Yeah, it's like a modular building. She had her knees up, resting her wrists on them. The pepper box muzzle of a Flechette pistol emerged from her hands. He realised that the glasses were surgically inset, sealing her sockets. The silver lenses seemed to grow from smooth, pale skin above her cheekbones, framed by dark hair cut in a rough shag. The fingers curled around the Fletcher were slender, white, tipped with polished burgundy. The nails looked artificial.
Molly is this sort of kind of like assassin, cyborg, bodyguard, leather-clad...
She's a razor girl. Her fingers turn into knives.
Yeah, yeah. She's got like a cat. She's got like razor blades at the end of her fingertips. It's one of her things.
Full name Molly Millions.
Full name Molly Millions. She's a feature in other books, apparently. Not that I've read any of them. I think the character is important because they are part of the set.
Molly is an extremely glamorous kind of hoodlum,
but also a professional. She's got a bit of like, you know, the professionals, as in you get together this like group of criminals to pull off a heist. She's like the one in the tight leather trousers with the massive machine gun. And the, like, mirror shades.
Although they're kind of grafted onto her face.
Yeah. Why would you do that? What's the advantage?
It's just cool, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's not cool. It's really stupid. But I can imagine it having a certain appeal.
Yeah.
That feels like the sort of thing you'd do when you were drunk and a teenager and would regret.
But her main thing is that she can make knives come out of the end of her fingers.
And that she's badass.
And she is badass.
I think that is definitely...
And she's, like, within her field, she's highly competent.
Omnicompetent. Yeah. Like, she can do everything. Omnicompetent, except she's not in the world of computers and things like that. She doesn't do technology, but she's, like, omnicompetent.
At pretty much all the other stuff.
All the other things, yeah.
And she's there because someone wants to see him.
You feel quite strongly, by the way, that she's omnicompetent in everything except that he does, so that he has a reason.
Yeah, he's got a lot more frailties.
So, a mysterious man wants to be his personal Jesus, save him from his crippledom, and get him to pull off one last heist.
So we have a scene in a hotel room where he meets this seemingly ex-military mysterious guy called Armitage, who, yeah.
What's Armitage like? I imagine him as like, you know, like Chomping Major with like... You know, the really short hair on the sides, shades, yeah. But in a suit?
I think so. I think he's a kind of, yeah, he's sort of Chomping Major, but sort of weirdly vacant.
Jack D. Ripper?
Yeah, I think kind of like that.
Yeah.
But sort of not so full of...
Not so fun.
Not so fun. And that's it. It's a job offer.
These elements are quite... understandable. I think it's the sort of mise-en-scene which makes it.
And we have these various contrivances which make it so that he can't refuse. So he's going to give him an operation so that he can go back into cyberspace, which is all he wants.
But it's got a sort of like timer on it. He's like, you know, he's like fixed everything but like put poison sacks in his body which will sort of pop on a predetermined limit to make sure that, you know, to contrive this.
So that he has to do the job.
I think we will keep coming back to Chiba because it's something that this first chapter is something, it's setting up this exciting underground world, this sort of neo Skid Row, or you know, or Vienna after the war, or Tokyo after the war. Those are also references, I think, as well as like Kowloon Walled City. I don't think Gibson had travelled very much. I mean, some before this, he says. But I think those things existed in images a lot in the movies.
Yeah, it's important that it's a setting which is totally kind of sick, but intensely glamorous at the same time.
And fairly, in a sense, lifeful. I mean, like, lots of people are doing things, not in a wholesome way. There's no sort of... You know, those places actually tend to be full of families getting on with it and kids playing on the roof. There's no children. There are no real children in this book at all. There's no families. Like, people's families are irrelevant. They're non-existent. There's none of that great body of life which gives it most of its pleasure and colour. You know, the emotional depth. There's no love.
They really get in the way.
There's none of that. None of that exists in this world, even. It's not even in the background. It just doesn't exist.
So I'll just do this quick quote from the cafe. It was decorated in a dated, nameless style from the previous century, an uneasy blend of Japanese traditional and pale Milanese plastics. But everything seemed to wear a subtle film, as though the bad nerves of a million customers had somehow attacked the mirrors and the once glossy plastics, leaving each surface fogged with something that could never be wiped away.
I like the fact that it's Milanese plastic. I like it. It's sort of it's 70s Italian design.
Yeah. One thing that is worth saying about Gibson is that, in terms of his background, is that he's a design obsessive. He's like a collector. He's someone that, if you read profiles, he has certain things which he's particularly obsessed with like male fashion, watches, these kinds of things, about which he does genuinely know an enormous amount.
Yeah.
And there is...
Yeah, there's quite a bit of...
The
sort of
the design obsessive's interest in provenance, industrial design, materials...
Brands.
And brands, yeah.
Very much brands.
So there's not all that much to say about the meeting in the hotel room. It's this other class of space, which are these very blank, empty, clean, spacious, kind of neutral environments, which are the prerogative of wealth.
Oh, the other thing I would say is we haven't said about the prose style, which is rich, dense. This is someone who definitely loves the sound of words. And there's a lot of sort of artifice. There's a lot of, well, what would you call it? Like, you know...
Yeah, it's this that mixture of erudition and the laconic.
Very highly mannered.
It's quite Chandlerian.
It's quite nice, but also not completely without effect, I would say.
And then we're in the sprawl, which is the kind of generic setting which gives its name to the whole trilogy of novels that Gibson wrote at this time, which is imagined as this like another vast city, and it's the conurbation of basically the entire east of the United States.
Well, cue the moment. Come on down the stair. You can buy us more. Yeah. Now that we've got that out of our system.
There's something in which is that throughout this book, descriptions of setting, description of objects, descriptions of the things which people possess are incredibly kind of pregnant with significant detail. He has this experience of going through his bags in the room that they're staying in, and they're full of stuff he doesn't remember buying. They're like full of weird clothes.
They've gone shopping sort of round Europe. Yeah. And time and space has sort of become delirious. You know, they're in Milan and they're in Amsterdam, but only for about a sentence. There's all these like boxes with, you know, those packaging puff polystyrene beads like scattered everywhere, and there's been some serious unboxing going on.
A new beginning in his life looks like a room with nothing in it but a foam mattress, and then boxes
of like expensive consumer products, which have been packed in like shrink wrap, and then a designer box, and then inside the box are like polystyrene beads, and inside that is a slab of something exciting and branded.
And the little beads are kind of dusted on the concrete floor like snow. And that's it. That's the new life. Yeah. Looks like that.
Come back with bags and bags. There's another character, the Finn. Yeah. There's his down and out tech den. And he's this kind of technology like physical hacker guy. Yeah. You know what hackers used to be, but when they went back when they did like telephone phreaking and made things out of other things, and his world is sort of like broken piles of electronics, things bolted onto things. I think it's worth saying this is probably written in the period around when proliferations of obsolete electronics first sort of came into being.
They stood in a clearing, dense tangles of junk rising on either side to walls lined with shelves of crumbling paperbacks. The junk looked like something that had grown there, a fungus of twisted metal and plastic. He could pick out individual objects, but then they seemed to blur back into the mass. The guts of a television so old it was studded with the glass stumps of vacuum tubes, a crumpled dish antenna, a brown fibre canister stuffed with corroded lengths of alloy tubing. An enormous pile of old magazines had cascaded into the open area, flesh of lost summers, staring blindly up as he followed her back through a narrow canyon of impacted scrap. The Finn is another recurring character who turns up in later books.
Why is he the Finn? Is he Finnish?
He doesn't seem Finnish, does he?
No.
Apart from that he eats herring at one point, which I guess is a sort of generic Nordic signifier.
Herring. Nothing wrong with eating herring. He's a character you go to... I mean, the whole thing fits very much into the kind of tradition of quest narratives, right? Where you meet these people and you meet wise people in the woods and they tell you the secret to... like defeating the dragon. And yeah, he's a sort of techno wrangler, but living on the underside. Gibson's not a great one for like actual wisdom. Yeah. It tends to be like keys. The person never says what they want is to have their own way, or the defeat or victory, it doesn't matter. He tends to say, take the fourth door on the left and turn the key three times.
Yeah. What does all the mess signify? I mean, is the mess really, is that his wisdom?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the piling up of... It's partly that it's a signifier of one of these people who loves tinkering. Some of those things are quite niche. He's got, like, packets of alloy tubes he has, like, left over from some project where he's making something out of alloy tubes. But also, it's into the woods. He's a wild, not part of society. To be capable or magical in this world is to be an outsider. Like, the power of the will, which is what motivates all of this, like, is you can do anything. You can't do anything, but you develop magical powers if you are an outsider beyond society with a will to difference and a focus, which gives you a sort of magical competence. The real world works like on real world, you know, people have jobs and they do things and get on with it. And then on the outside, there's magic.
And the real world, people are literal drones.
They are almost completely absent. There's a few points where they're being mowed down with machine guns or running or like being kicked in the head or being like stamped on or being eviscerated. But that's the sort of thing they tend to be having their like head slammed in a door.
I think one of the things which for me is distinctive and really interesting about Gibson's fiction, which is very present in the character of the Finn, I would say that he's interested in what you might call material culture. The idea that the information and the knowledge, the sort of the secrets, are all encoded in objects which have been designed and manufactured. And in a way, the Finn's command over his area of expertise is sort of enshrined in these great, enormous, disordered, but all-containing piles of stuff. This layering of materials of things of different ages, which I think we'll talk more about in the context of Istanbul. Everything is sort of saturated in these kind of details which are very concise. It's a kind of a mise-en-scene which is extremely...
This is the word. Like a few episodes ago, the word was allied.
Yeah.
That was Rand's word. Yeah. This one is mise-en-scene.
It is mise-en-scene, though, because...
Yeah,
like,
I know, you're right.
Mise-en-scene is literally... is from, like, from cinema, it's what you put in the frame to make the scene.
I think originally, when you're putting on a theatre production, and you can only put a few things... Yeah. On the stage.
Yeah.
It's the few things you put on to symbolise the environment.
What Gibson does incredibly successfully is to use these few little cues which you can drop into this very compressed, very tightly written background in a way which convincingly conjures an extremely sort of rich and fascinating world. I think that that's one of the things which is distinctive about his writing. You know, when you were talking about it being filmic, I think that that's one of the things which it's doing. So we're going to go on to the raid on SenseNet. The setup for this is that they're instructed that they need to recover a personality ROM construct from the SenseNet pyramid, which is the consciousness of this old hacker, McRoy Pawley, who's dead, but his consciousness has been downloaded onto this thing like a big games cartridge.
But it's not actually a consciousness. It's a simulation. It can run a simulation, a static simulation of him.
Yeah.
So when you turn it off, he's gone, and he's got no ability to lay down memories. It's just like him, and it's a ROM, which implies that it's unable to like learn or save anything. That's I think the key thing. Yeah, and it's very clearly a games cartridge,
and it's in this vast complex which is essentially dedicated to the storage of hundreds and hundreds and thousands of these constructs.
Mm.
Has a big corporate data library full of them.
I read through this passage twice, and the first time I thought the company had this arm which stored them, and the rest of the time it was like some sort of computer research center. And the second time I thought it was like a big media company, but actually we discussed it and it's just like a library. But it's a bit funny because it's got, like, this whole town-sized office.
It must have some other activities, but they're not really outlined. And the plan is like this. It's extremely closely guarded, and they will have to simultaneously physically break in with Molly, and also, using cyberspace, hack through the security and deactivate the lock on the container where the ROM is contained.
So he's invented this like writing technology, which is in order to be sort of cinematic, where you know, in the cinema you can make these fast cuts between different places. Molly has implanted in her brain or something, yeah, this transmitter, which allows other people with a corresponding receiver, yeah, to receive her sensory perception, all of it. So like everything she's feeling, not her like inner monologue, but her like her sort of exterior senses. And he has the corresponding like receiver for that, which means that he can see what she's doing and do like the computer stuff with it. But it doesn't, it's a one-way transmission. So when he wants to talk to her, he rings someone up on the phone and they ring her up on the phone.
But they're going to need, yeah, so she'll be doing that. He'll be in cyberspace, hacking in. But they're going to need more than that. They're going to need a big old distraction. And for this, they employ the services of, I think they're, can best be described as conceptual art terrorists, the Panther Moderns, yeah, who are this band of like extremely peculiar young men and women who they love doing violence, but really creatively.
There are something like, if you got the sort of X-Men complete with their like technological, complete with their like administrative back end, and crossed them with the Droogies, or whatever they're called, in Clockwork Orange. Yeah. It's sort of like that.
They're very high tech.
They've got sort of superpowers, which are technologically explained.
Yeah, they have these sort of camouflaging suits.
They've got a strong administrative system where they're all doing like Roger and out.
And they have
Funny haircuts,
and they have a good understanding of how to manipulate the sort of infrastructure of government and security in order to cause maximum chaos.
I think part of the inspiration for them must be biker gangs.
Or I was thinking kind of the Manson family. Like, there's a little bit of, there's a sort of cultishness.
Are they all teenagers, do you think?
I think they're all
like 17.
Yeah, yeah.
But they can do things like, you know, they're super high tech. They can sort of disappear with active camouflage and whiz around, and they're all like Alpha Bravo, Charlie to 238, sort of as well. Which is military, obviously. It's also like A-Team as well. A bit of the A-Team, a bit...
Yeah, if the A-Team were nihilistic terrorists who'd read loads of like Deleuze and Guattari, maybe...
Yeah, without really understanding what it was about, like everyone else who reads.
And their plan is all about simulation and dissimulation. They do two things. One is that they tell the authorities, they essentially send a kind of fake admission of a terrorist release of a kind of homicidal hallucinogenic drug. And they say that they've released this inside the SenseNet pyramid.
It's lovely. This is a drug that turns like normal people into savage killers.
Is a savage maniacs. And then simultaneously, they broadcast a kind of subliminal message inside the pyramid, which makes everyone in the pyramid completely freak out and start running around and trying to escape. And then there's the collision of everyone trying to run out of the pyramid looking completely bonkers, and all of the security turning up the pyramid to make sure that a bunch of homicidal maniacs aren't all rampaging around. And the inevitable happens, and there's an enormous sort of shootout.
Shoot up,
yeah. Where, in which these huge foam barricades are sprayed in front of the building, and they basically machine gun all of the salary
All men. The office workers, yeah. I mean, all the way through this, this is something I found slightly problematic, but Luke tells me is completely normal in this sort of thing. Like, sort of off-screen characters are being murdered for no apparent reason without anyone batting an eyelid. Like, at the beginning it said, Chase has killed 3 people in the last month for no particular reason, and he's meant to be this sort of lovable rogue.
So they take advantage of all of that to recover the construct, to recover the game's cartridge. Yeah, and then to escape.
So the experience from Case's point of view is this strange dual thing where you're switching very quickly between his view of cyberspace and Molly's. So Molly is sort of infiltrating, you know, she's like pretending to be someone and then changing clothes and, you know, like one of these like crime heist things. And one of the important things for her also is that she's got the time, like in a digital clock, displayed into her vision, which allows for this continuous, which happens a few times, this continuous like readout of the time, and sort of you see the seconds going on. And case hacking, you know, this is Unix, I know this. And it's all about breaking through ice, which I think is like intrusion countermeasures. Which is, he's sort of like getting to the, you know, there's various walls and he's getting through this sort of, it's a bit like the Kabbalah crossed with geometry lesson.
Case's virus had bored a window through the library's command ice. He punched himself through and found an infinite blue space ranged with colour-coded spheres strung on a tight grid of pale blue neon. In the non-space of the matrix, the interior of a given data construct possessed unlimited subjective dimension. A child's toy calculator accessed through Case's Sendai would have presented limitless gulfs of nothingness, hung with a few basic commands. Case began to key the sequence the Finn had purchased from a mid-echelon salaryman with severe drug problems. He began to glide through the spheres as if he were on invisible tracks. Chill blue neon vault above him, starless and smooth as frosted glass, he triggered a sub-program that affected certain alterations in the core custodial commands, reversing smoothly, the virus knitting the fabric of the window. One of the things about cyberspace is that it's a space, and that you move around by, you kind of dial these particular coordinates, and you're always at a given sort of Cartesian defined point within the three-dimensional hallucination.
You have sort of a velocity as well, I think.
Yeah. One of the things about it is that it's kind of a landscape, and the vertical dimension is quite consequential. So early on, the construct tells him that AIs are always very, very high up. They're very, very, very high up in the space, whereas most things are sort of spread around as these kind of cuboidal or spherical objects in this night landscape.
I think there's a literal metaphor of, like, you know, routine, subroutine. You know, at the bottom, I think there's sort of assembly code, right?
Hmm.
It's a bit like that.
Oh, right, so we're in the stack, are we?
I think it's a bit like that. Not that elaborate. And I think the other thing is that it is very early 3D graphics. Like the 3D graphics in like early 3D shoot 'em up games. Like, what was that one with foxes where you're basically fighting triangles and spheres, because that was all that like the NES could render. It's that sort of, it's that world of like primary geometries.
He talks about it as a transparent 3D chessboard extending to infinity. The stepped scarlet pyramid of the Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority, the green cubes of Mitsubishi Bank of America. High and very far away, he saw the spiral arms of military systems.
It's only cool stuff. He hasn't quite gotten on that people will have, like, he said that schools will, but actually the only people that have things in their network are corporate, and the military is not really the military of a state, it's just corporate military, really.
And there are these structures of ice, which is security, which if you get embedded in it, it can kill you in real life.
Earlier on, he's going through various walls.
Yeah.
You know, reaching the reason why I said it like Kabbalah is he's always like reaching the seventh gate. And
one of the things which obviously is kind of charming about it is that sort of hacking is kind of a computer game. What really is going on in the computer, you know, zeros and ones are nowhere here. The lowest level is the big glowing computer game.
I think what's quite nice is this came up before, as I was discussing, the contemporary user illusion. There's the notion of a user illusion where when you click on something, you think that you are clicking on a thing and sort of interacting in that way. And actually, it is just this massive projection of the computer, which is rearranging, you know, hexadecimal pairs. And all of it is just little packets of electrons being arranged on. I don't think that, or I think that sort of had been established, but it hadn't been established yet for William Gibson completely. It's still for him more computer games than, you know, more video arcades than it is computers in the sort of way that we think, you know, personal computers. It means that firstly, the world is computer games. That's what computers are. Yeah. They're arcade games. And it's just an arcade game that instead of you looking at it through a screen is projected into your brain by, like, electromagnets. Although people do jack things into their brain, the way he works is he's got, like, a skull cap, I think. You know, those things they're put on to measure your brain waves. I think it's like that, but with sort of, like, occasionally he has some consciousness of what's going on around him as well. I think it's like sort of dream state. You can be in and out.
I think in the Paris Review interview, Gibson talks about the moment when he had this intuition about cyberspace, being in one of those big coin-operated arcades, which were a lot more numerous in the days before home video consoles, and watching everybody playing like Asteroids and Pac-Man and all of these things which were around at the time, and having this very, very strong intuition that what all the kids who spent all their evenings playing this really wanted was to be inside the machine. So it connects to something which is broadly true of his approach to writing science fiction and thinking about technology, which is that it's all about desire.
They're not the careful desires of, like, Osium Con Dignitato is not part of that desire network.
Yeah, it's very much lizard brain. It's like, you want it, you grab it.
Like someone giving you presents, and you, like, unwrap them, throw them away, and get another one.
Do we want to say anything about the actual SenseNet pyramid?
Well, I really wanted to talk about it, and then I read it again carefully, and the sum total of details, it's a pyramid. It has a lobby, which has steel planters with palms in it. It has generic lifts and corridors with carpet. And there are security men. And it's got a sort of vault, which is a bit like a server room.
Yeah.
You know, with like glass cabinets with blinking lights. I suspect he never had an office job. He just gives slightly the impression of never having done much of a lick of a day's work in his life. That may be somewhat unfair.
I've got no idea about that.
I don't think he's done a job where you had to wear a uniform. Because if he had, I think he would have more insights about... Because as soon as you go into those environments, they have all sorts of strange stuff going on. They have all sorts of interesting stuff going on in offices. And in fact, wherever you work, any place of work, there's always loads of human behaviour and, like, physical culture going on. And I think that would have been stimulating.
One thing is that at this point it becomes clear that... this is actually a sort of classic heist story, where the arc of the story is that we're going to put together this team. So we've got Molly, we've got Case, we've got McRoy, Paulie, the ROM construct, we've got Armitage, we've got to get one more, and then we're going to do the job. Also, within that, classically, once you've put the team together, everyone starts warring with each other, tension builds within the team, motives become... sort of overshadowed and confused. People's backgrounds and past sort of start to interfere with the smooth running of what's going on, and all sorts of other contingencies come in. They've got one more person they need to retrieve. We go through a little bit of wondering who Armitage is. It turns out that he's really a guy called Colonel...
Although you wonder who he is for about two pages and then find out.
Yeah. yeah. You find out. So he's this guy who's been recovered from... a sort of military asylum, who was extremely badly maimed and sort of traumatized on a top secret mission called Screaming Fist. And Armitage isn't his real name. Also, we learn...
he really is like the A-Team. He's like...
Yeah.
He's like special forces who've been done over by the military-industrial complex and framed for a crime they didn't commit.
Except that he's like a shell of a man.
Yeah.
Rather than being kind of wisecracking and cool.
Yeah. There's not much wisecracking in the book at all, really.
No. And he's this very kind of... he's another... like Paulie, he's another construct, but he's a kind of psychological construct on top of this, like, sort of broken mass of trauma.
What's happened is his trauma has, like, made him completely... he's had post-traumatic stress to the point where he doesn't exist as a person. And then he's had these implants in, and then one of them has been whispering to him and has, like, taken control of him, and now he's a cyborg.
They've got to get one more member of the team... while they're on their way to do that, they also are discovering who's really behind the operation. And it's an AI called Wintermute, which is this mysterious intelligence living in the Matrix.
Well, no, not living in the Matrix.
Well, living on its server in Bern, in Switzerland somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is the sort of plaything of an incredibly rich aristocratic family, the Tessier Ashpools.
Well, like, even before this point, remember, it's like just after the SenseNet thing, one of the teenage gang with his like pink spiky, one of his fashion accessories that I quite like is, there's a lot of sort of fun, ridiculous fashion accessories. One of his is he has massive tufts of hair growing out of his ears, which are pink.
Nice.
His pointy elf ears.
Yeah.
And he tells him cryptically, "I have a message for you, Wintermute." What's the message? the message, Wintermute. And then he spins around three times and goes into camouflage.
It's great. It's great. Silly.
And he also, like, the spinning around is like, and he does a little jig. He's basically a leprechaun.
Yeah.
He does a little jig and waves his arms around and then disappears.
The last member of the team who they need is Peter Riviera.
He's a rotter, isn't he?
He's like a psychopathic illusionist who is able to create, through these implants which he has in his body, something like a sort of augmented reality of these shimmering images, which he creates with the power of his mind, and he uses his gifts for evil. He's a sociopath and a sort of sexual sadist.
But also, his powers go beyond just projecting. He actually has the ability to somehow, through some sort of strange gene, so sort of Svengali powers, like mesmeric powers, he can work his way into the weak's mind. Not the strong, but like people who aren't the main characters, he can basically completely get them to do whatever he wants.
And like most people in this book, he's also a junkie.
There aren't emotions, for the most part. There are a few at a few points. But mainly there's just chemically altered states. And mainly people can't, like, mainly people, like, they're sort of switched off, and then you sort of put the coin into the slot, which is like a mixture of a powerful cocktail of drugs, but highly specific to each person. Like, you know, this person will be like phenylbenzadrine and, and, you know, ginkgo, or whatever it is. And then suddenly they like spark into life and become their merry selves or whatever it is, psychopaths.
And they have to pick him up from Istanbul, where he's a sort of a creature of the secret police and doing these sort of dirty shows for people.
It's quite clear that we are not meant to like him.
He's not a good guy. The sort of save the cat moment for him is that he likes to walk down the street, and every time a cyclist goes past, he makes them believe that there's a scorpion on the handlebars, so they fall off and hurt themselves.
That's quite attractive. I mean, that's something we can all sympathize. That's the sort of... But he also does all sorts of nasty things. He's a nasty, nasty piece of work.
Istanbul is... It sort of has in common with the other cities that there are these like big corporate arcology complexes, and everything else is sort of streaky brick and plywood shack. Maybe we could talk a little bit about Istanbul, but about the cities generally. We drive past a lot of shacks and we sort of wander through the streets and things. But I made this list of sort of Gibsonian materials, which are foam, epoxy, chipboard, tape, spray, silicon caulk.
Yeah.
You got any others?
Zips, which are being unzipped and zipped up, and old bits of sort of the stuff that you would see in a travel magazine now, but kind of decayed. And so in Istanbul, it's like souks and cobbled streets with shops with grills on them. Wherever you go, there's sort of some of the holiday snap stuff that was there before. There's always some of what's there now in the sort of picturesque definition. And then there's a shanty town and an acropolis. Every single bedroom in the thing has this, like, it's a something foam mattress.
Temper foam.
And it is always called, and every time you're in a bedroom, there is always a description of the temper foam mattress. Every single time anyone sleeps, there's a description of the temper foam mattress they sleep on. They're all slightly different.
They're different colours.
Some of them are posh and pretending to be something else. One of them is pretending to be Bermuda sand.
Yeah.
Some of them are ripped to shreds and you sort of lie in them like a pile of garbage. There is more description of mattresses in this book, probably, than all the other books I've ever read put together. There's one non-temper. There's the striped real mattress of his teenage years, which he sleeps on without sheets. So there's one non-temper foam mattress. They're not long descriptions. But I can't think of a single bedroom where the mattress is not described.
Yeah, as with the mattress, so with everything else. They're materials which are highly processed, they're chemical, they're cheap, they sort of require very little expertise to use. They're like bodging materials. A very characteristic detail is that someone has stuck one thing to something else unsuitable with like epoxy cement, which is a thing which comes up again and again and again. It happens, like, right in this hotel in the first chapter, where the elevator has been lashed to the building with bamboo and epoxy.
Which is that slight Asian construction site feel, but also just that, like, I reckon he's hanging around loads of messy people's rooms, and there's all this pile of junk, and there's just this sort of sense of junk being lashed together and making things out of it.
but it's distinctive in a science fiction context because this is not what it's like normally. This level of attention to the tendency to make everything with the minimum of effort.
Commercial materials. Repurposed consumer stuff.
Also that everything is... that the obsolescent hangs around for a long time and is incorporated.
I think it's partly because things become obsolescent so quickly. Yeah. I think it's partly that the technological frontier is... which is rapidly shifting into a consumer frontier. I think this is a world in which, although it's not articulated that clearly, planned obsolescence, which I think was a very known sort of notion, is kind of run rampant. But also, everything is being retrofitted in a quite charming way. Yeah. Even billionaires retrofit everything.
Yeah, it's just that billionaires retrofit incredibly rare and expensive things. There are some, I think, kind of hotels. Hotels is new. Bases of luxury are new. I think newness actually is the preserve of luxury. Newness and neatness. It's a world in which, you know, it's as if there's a sort of dial for chaos and it's been turned up. And that if you have money, you can buy immunity from it.
Not that you necessarily want to. I like the conservative Japanese ladies in their sackcloth and fake bruises.
What's that?
It's in there, it's a description. I think it's in Chiba.
It's a thing that they do.
And he passes this gaggle of like rich ladies dressed old fashionedly, which is you like wear sackcloth and ashes and like dress up as if you've been beaten by your husband. There's a lot of sort of completely incidental descriptions of these sort of bonkers outfits. You're walking down the city street. And people are like, and you don't even get a second look at the person at the sort of fashion statement, which is looking like a battered wife as a fashion statement, is just, you know, it's sort of like hyper city, where the provincial sort of homogeneity has been completely eliminated.
These kind of settings turn up again and again in Gibson's work. The trilogy of novels which he wrote after this one, after the Sprawl trilogy, is the Bridge trilogy, which is all set around a kind of like vast shanty town on the Bay Bridge off San Francisco. It's kind of interesting to consider what that's meant to be about, these accretive...
His favelas have got a strong sort of thing of box park around them.
Yeah, no, what people do in the Bridge is that they go and set up like an oyster bar with Mexican beer or something, or like a fried chicken shop. It's very sort of like the type of street feast market stall.
Yeah, also the kind of, you know, in Shoreditch you go past and every shop has got like an ironized title. All the hairdressers are called, like, Bad Hair Day.
I was rereading, is it Virtual Light, I think, which is the first one of the trilogy. And, you know, literally the Bridge is full of hipster bike shops. It's full of people who make fixie bikes. It's full of...
small batch.
Yeah. It's an interesting fusion. I think it hasn't worn that well.
Because they haven't spent lots of time working in architecture offices, they don't... None of these worlds ever have lots and lots of, like... rickety false ceilings, like with like broken acoustic tiles, which really is like the place where the guts always, like the instant, it's the place where you always see under the hood. Yeah. To the point where nowadays, this is a slight aside, there is definitely an architectural rhetoric about aestheticized service spaces. You know, that high-tech thing has gone into, like, the sort of silvered and, like, slatted things above the, like, louvered,
translucent... Yeah, you have the floating strip LEDs, and then above it, the intestinal service ducts and all of the wiring and everything else. Do we want to say, so they get him... There's a short bit on the sort of the non-space of the airport that they pass through. Do you want anything about that?
There are lots of locations, but often they don't really exist. Yeah. They're two or three objects and a sense of an airport, which in a sense points to a strength in the writing, which is that something can be passed through with such a light touch, but it doesn't give you a lot of meat for spatial analysis.
They pass through these airports, they pass to the spaceport, And their ultimate destination, which they know now, is the space station of Freeside, in which they need to do, in a similar way to the raid on SenseNet, a sort of a dual raid simultaneously on the physical space of the home of the sort of rich founders, and simultaneously on the cyber space of its security locks, which are surrounding this AI, which wants to be freed and allowed to reunite with its twin, Neuromancer, which is a sort of parallel AI, technically located in Rio, but conceptually they're like these two halves of the brain which want to unite and then... Actually, rather than really going to Freeside, what they do is to go to this of strange orbiting to another shanty town, but this time it's the space shanty of Zion, this accretive space station built out of rubbish by space rasters.
Yeah, which is, they're just listening to endless reggaeton smoking ganja, yeah.
And it's all held together with, like, spray paint and silicon.
Yeah, it's a space station, basically, that gives a strong impression of being made out of plywood and creaky tin. But they're all, like, really mystical and high.
Yeah, yeah.
The space rasters.
And they love Molly.
Why do they go there? I can't remember why they go
there.
This
is where they're going to sort of set up their base of operations. Or like, initially...
Looking back on it, it's like the reason to go there is to just, like... Get the space rasters in, isn't it?
Yeah, get the space rasters in.
And you're picking up a couple more characters, like... Yeah.
Malcolm, Errol.
Yeah, the sideies in this are a sort of small posse of...
Yeah, Remington 45 toting space rasters.
Yeah, everyone's a badass. Yeah. Everyone's a badass in this.
I think one thing that happens, which we shouldn't skip over, is that Case goes back into cyberspace, and with McCoy, whatever his name is, the ROM construct, who's his sort of wingman now in cyberspace, they decide on a whim to go and have a look at their employer.
Before this point, there have been hints about what AIs are like from the character inside the ROM, who's killed by one and has met it several times. And he's telling the young Padawan.
I don't think he was killed by it, but his nickname is the Dixie Flatline, because he was
he dies, but then so he goes back for a second touch, doesn't he? Isn't killed by it.
Oh, is that what killed? Oh, right.
I thought that was it. I thought, like, he met it once, he survived, and everyone was like, "This guy survived," and then the second time it got him.
This is a thing which Case is going to do multiple times: have his heart stopped by the. By the AI, and it's the main...
And there's always a description of how many seconds exactly afterwards.
Case punched for the Swiss banking sector, feeling a wave of exhilaration as cyberspace shivered, blurred, gelled. The Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority was gone, replaced by the cool geometric intricacy of Zurich commercial banking. He punched again for Bern. That's interesting, isn't it? You have to sort of jump around.
It's a bit like trunk telephone calls, I think. It's like, you know, and also it's like focus. It's like a CCTV camera going like, whoop!
Up, the construct said. It'll be high. They ascended lattices of light, level strobing, a blue flicker. Wintermute was a simple cube of white light, that very simplicity suggesting extreme complexity. It doesn't look like much, does it? The flatline said. But just you try and touch it. Case punched to within 4 grid points of the cube. Its blank face, towering above him now, began to seethe with faint internal shadows, as though 1,000 dancers whirled behind a vast sheet of frosted glass. Case punched again, once. They jumped forward by a single grid point. A stippled, grey circle formed on the face of the cube. Case felt the edge of the deck sting his palm as he slapped max reverse. The matrix blurred backwards. They plunged down a twilit shaft of Swiss banks. He looked up. The sphere was darker now, gaining on him. The dark came down like a hammer.
Yeah, don't mess with it.
It got him. But when he wakes up, he's not where he was before.
The AI is really just a god.
A demon.
Or ghost. It's able to create these sort of environments at will. Anything it sees, it assumes and can recreate in its mind, and is able to abstract people from reality into a dream space.
the place where it takes you to is a composite, a sort of collage of your own memories and particularly your desires, really. So that where it takes Case is actually back to Chiba, back to where he was before.
Which is exactly the dream space.
There's this acknowledgement that although this was like his lowest, it's him at rock bottom, but it's also the place to which he wants to return more than anything. I think that's really interesting, and maybe I think we're running quite long now, so maybe we could just talk a little bit about why that might be.
Yeah, and it's the realm of desire. So he is a creature in Chiba of this like list of desires, which are all in a sense being satisfied, and in order for the pleasure to exist, you have to have the satiation of desire. But it is also the world which is most abstracted from the white flight corporate suburbia. So it's the seat of desire, the distant edge, outer fringe. And it has, you know, Linda, this girl who's sort of like briefly his lover and is killed, who is a sort of symbol for, you know, who's this like butterfly.
Yeah.
And is like youthful and optimistic and then crushed and then rapidly killed as the response of being attached to him. Is a symbol of a sort of, he's in love with the idea of it. There's also, though, an important element in which it is nostalgia for a previous state of life, a detached one, and a one driven by pleasure. In the classic sort of adventure story, you've got your previous world, and you are then abstracted from it into a world of wonder. And then there's a different state of the story if you're going to return, changed, or if you're never going to return. Or if the change that you have undergone, you know, my favourite example, Winnie the Pooh. He goes into the world, the magical world, and is changed by it, and then returns and can never go back because he's no longer a boy. There is this wrenching nostalgia for the world of Winnie the Pooh. You know, the child has grown up, he cannot return, he's moved on in a state of life. And I think the dystopic state in this one has, it has this sort of teenage freedom, rebellion, desire, satiation of desire, but also the running away from the world of responsibilities and life. He's not, this is the world of not choosing life, this is the world of the exciting drug culture and the fulfillment of these immediate desires, which include centrally this image of loving a frail object. And I think it's very crucial that it's an image because the relationship is utterly insubstantive. The like tender, innocent face in the reflected glare of the like consuming technology, showing the signs of her vulnerability and self-destruction, childishly smiling or something. There's sort of several levels of desire in Case, but it's very important that there's a place that he is free and sort of desires now it's gone. Yeah. So we're going to go and you're going to desire us in our absence.
Yeah, but we'll be back. In the meantime, thanks for various tweets, iTunes reviews. Please write more.
Oh, everyone's been very nice, yes.
Yeah, please write more. And if someone could write another iTunes review, maybe the one which says we have really bad audio quality might be pushed off the bottom of the first screen, which would be nice.
But we do, I mean, oh, here's a good one. I'm moving.
Yeah.
The next place is not right next to a train line.
Yeah, but it's right next to a very busy street.
It's a good train. Yeah, but it's a largely pedestrianised street.
Yeah.
It's just got lots of people on it.
You can always email at us at aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com and find all the various links to subscribe at aboutbuildingsandcities.org. Anything?
You've been wonderful. Thanks for putting up with us.
Yeah, all right. And we'll be with you again soon.
Yeah. And then your nostalgia will evaporate like morning mist.
Yeah, like, what is it? Mist off the shoal of waste.
you've described, in this in your matter, you've described 17 separate mattresses. Is there any particular reason for this?